Otherwise, I will pass over to István. And while Jürgen shows us what the task means if you come from the hardware side, I think István will give us an impression what the same task of preserving complex digital artifacts means if you have the perspective from the media side, from the floppy disk side, or from the media drive. Yeah, please start.
Thank you, Andreas. First of all, let me tell you a few things about myself that are not so interesting. Basically, I work in telecom. That is not the most exciting work, of course, and I have been always fascinated by games. In fact, I used to be a games developer for quite some time, and it is one of the reasons why CAPS, or the Classic Amiga Preservation Society, has been born. In the following minutes, I'm going to say a few things about what we are doing. This is very technical in nature, so we tried, when writing this speech, we tried to abstract the technical details from what we are doing. I'm sure that some of you might be interested how these things work, and if there are questions asked, I'm going to answer them. I found CAPS in 2001. Having developed a few games myself, I found it quite annoying that the software that was available on the internet was usually pirated copies of various games. As some of you might be aware, that the common use for copy protection on the Amiga, or in fact any other computing platform, meant that they wanted to stop the people from copying the legal obtained copies of the games they bought. It is a common misconception that copy protection was applied to prevent everyone from copying games. In fact, it was applied to prevent legitimate customers from copying the newly bought games to their neighbors. That is often referred as casual copying. For example, when someone bought a game, him likely a kid or a teenager, it was quite normal to share that game with a friend or schoolmate or anyone else that was close to vicinity. Of course, publishers were not really happy with that, and of course, they are still not very happy with that, which is still very understandable. In that time, there had to be a solution to prevent this happening, and that solution was copy protection. Unfortunately, applying copy protection to software, especially to game software, meant that practically only altered, hacked, and modified games can be extracted and used as of today on the internet through emulation or any other means. Quite simply because copy protection on many of the systems got so much advanced that it was practically impossible to make a working copy of certain titles. I will get into detail on that, how that was applied. So our aim as CAPS is to ensure that games are preserved how they were originally intended to be. As it now stands, we have preserved well over 1,800 titles in their original form, and just exactly the way we were used to get at retail at production. That means every single bit on the disk preserved, including copy protection, game code, data, music, sound effects, whatever that was there, is still intact and in there. Soon, we are going to change, just as Andrex explained already, to the Software Preservation Society, and there are many reasons for that. both technical and practical. Basically, we started with Amiga because we love Amiga, of course, but another reason was that it has the most sophisticated copy protection available for an obsolete system right now. Anything else you would find out is much simpler to deal with normally, so long you can find working copies of the disk themselves. Okay. So let's have a few words about games preservation. I think we can agree that, and we have already agreed yesterday at the panel, that games are a form of art itself. It's just very unfortunate and a shame that they do not get treated as such. Just recently, this is changing, but basically it is still not being taught generally as art, at more like a leisure activity. Computer gaming is still a relatively new form of entertainment, and these games are the beginning of it. They should be treated with respect they deserve and kept accessible for future generations to enjoy. Unfortunately, this art form has been locked away, imprisoned by its own storage media, and destined to rot. All of the disks eventually will, and in the not very distant future, will die. Not only that, the hardware required to run these games becomes less common, but most importantly, less accessible. Only with the help of the communities around these older machines can we hope to preserve as many games as is possible. Even though CAPS have a large software collection, it is not everything, and many of our copies of the software flowed in ways that I am going to explain very shortly. Let's have a few words about the technical issues. Basically, this is a technological and technical problem, what we are dealing with, quite simply because it was an industry and still is an industry itself to protect software. But what there are many things that we can't and shouldn't disclose, quite simply because the very same kind of copy protection methods are still applied, only the media has changed. For example, you will find exactly the same kind of copy protection in principle on CDs and DVDs for PlayStation 2 or Xbox that have been used a few years ago on floppy disks or other media, mostly floppy disks. So, get to the problem. Preserving software, especially that which is stored magnetic media, such as floppy disk, is pretty hard. We are not talking about simply taking an image of the disk and storing it. Due to the technical difficulties already explained, it just doesn't work with most of the original software. We need to guarantee that what we have is authentic to how it was originally produced and does not contain any errors. Of course, we are, as our name implies, about preserving software. So just taking an image and say that it is preserved, it is not enough. most of the games used to have two kind of, or sometimes three kind of copy protection or access control methods, as they like to put it these days. One of them was the disk format itself, which is not really to be confused with copy protection. It is just a side effect that many of the disk formats that have been used with computer games are quite simply impossible to copy. But in order to further enhance the chances that these games are not getting copied, many other techniques have been applied that make it very hard to reproduce the same way that the content that was originally mastered. So about the disk format, Every floppy-based computer system will have a standard disk format or formats. This may be rigidly defined by the floppy disk controller, or FDC in short, such as you can find in the Atari ST or your desktop PC. Or it might be more flexible, like the Commodore Amiga bare-bones FDC, where most of the work is done in software. One of the reasons we choose sampling hardware using to creating disk images at the raw flux level is that the Amiga pretty much lacks any of the sophisticated FDC control methods that are available on most of the desktop systems, including contemporary ones. And basically, what you read is the flux translations on the disks. We can get into detail later in the question section. I don't want to get too technical right now. The disk format contains, among other things, an addressing system to keep track of the data, which is not a filing system itself. The filing system depends on the operating system, be it a standard operating system like Linux, Windows, or Amiga DOS in that time, or PC or ST-DOS. But quite often, when games took over the system completely, they only used the operating system to boot enough data to take complete control over the system, and then do everything at a very low level, accessing the hardware directly. You can still find that approach in, for example, PlayStation 2 titles that are pushing the hardware enough, like GT4 Prologue or something like that is not exactly using the Sony PlayStation developer APIs, while simpler games do. We are keeping track of the data, the various integrity checks that is surrounded around the data, and the data itself. These things are organized in various different ways, and the computer has no hope of making any sense of out of a disk format unless it is known how to make it readable. Games on PC and Atari ST will have the same basic disk format as defined by the full-blown FDC. The bottleneck of the system is that the FDC already has a firmware that controls how it works, so the protection that can be applied is somewhat limited, luckily. However, systems such as an Amiga has literally hundreds, if not thousands, of unique disk formats, and many of them are just created for one game, especially if the game was meant to be a hit. So it got already very good press releases, was hyped up, and hope to sell a lot of copies, then it was quite natural to ask either the applicator firm or the authors themselves to create a unique format for that specific game in order to slow down piracy. Copy protection. Oops. Okay, so back to copy protections. Copy protection magnetic media is a deliberate attempt to keep piracy under control, we already know that. Although the disk format may contribute to this, and quite often does, it is not really its primary purpose. Employing copy protection usually involves creating effects on the media that can be read, or at least detected, that its presence can be detected through software, but cannot be written. At least not by the average user or consumer. Examples of copy protection is a bit technical, but we'll give you a very short overview. A disk contains tracks of data. that is at the most basic level is track of raw data. On magnetic material, it is called flux transitions. And flux transitions, or the lack of flux transitions, are what are defining the bit cells themselves. The bit cells themselves represent an encoding, which could be anything that the hardware or the magnetic media allows, such as the most important ones are FM, MFM, GCR. What you can do to prevent copying software, let's say on magnetic media, is to alter the way how these bit cells behave in themselves. You can reduce or extend the width of the basic elements on a disk, those are the bit cells, by an amount which the FDC can still read but cannot write. And basically, this means that through using a commercial application solution, you can define that one bit cells will be, instead of the standard 2 microseconds, will take 3 microseconds to complete, or it could be anything else. And why the normal FDC has a working window and so-called jitter or compensation for jitter hardware that allows dynamic changes in behavior of the data, the FDC itself is not capable of reproducing such data, at all it is capable to getting customized to the data characteristics that are being read, and modify the way the bits are interpreted accordingly to the dynamic changes in the surface magnetic environment. Another very, we can see here at the picture, normal track. We have created a quite complex analyzer system that allows us to see pretty much everything what is written on disk. What you see on the picture on the left side is a normal readout of a track of data. You can see there is a purple line which is basically pretty noisy, but gets close to the so-called optimal readout of the surface. What you see as the blue line is the result of trend analysis applied to it, and shows considering the data that is being stored at, how the data was meant to be written. When you write to magnetic media, you have a side effect that the different charges of the particles can attract or oppose each other. There is a technique called precompensation, which deals with this problem, but we are not yet going into that. On the right side of the picture, there is a special protection system, at least the trend of it, trend analysis, and it is called CopyLock Amiga, and it is pretty self-explanatory that it was meant to prevent copying the data. What it does, that it alters the bit cells to have 5% more and 5% less speed. The speed is determined by bunching a lot of bit cells together and measuring the time it takes to read all the flux translations. And to apply these speed changes to the very same track, computers and general copy programs are not able to deal with this. There is one exception to this rule, we will get into that. They are called analog copiers. They are able to copy this, but there is no guarantee that it will work since how it is implemented. Another way of protecting software is using the so-called flaky or weak bits. These are bits that are, when read, do not show a stable state. In fact, They are either read out as one or zeros, depending on the conditions, the exact rotation time of the drive, which is compensated by the so-called window and the jitter hardware of the drive. So normally, when you run a drive at a fairly constant speed, like say 300 RPMs, that is 300 revolutions per minute, You would think that it is a fairly constant rate, but in fact it is not. That it is allowed to change slightly, a little bit. So this technique works the way that there are certain signal levels that should be applied to the particles on the disk, and if they are below a certain threshold, then they contain a zero. And if they are above the threshold, they are interpreted as one. This is just a basic explanation. It gets slightly more complex than that, especially on CDs or any other, or DVDs, but we are not going to discuss how they work on that. But they are referred on CDs and DVDs as weak bits. This is creating bits that are, as I said, looking pretty much random when they are read. What the software does to determine whether the copy is an original of the game or just a simple copy, it tries to read the data several times. And if it reads out the very same data all the times or below a certain threshold, then it decides it is a copy. Unfortunately, this means that quite often original games stop to work due to this, because the magnetism of the disk is changing over time, especially if we are talking about tens of years. Another way of protecting software is hiding data within well-known disk structures. And such data is normally not copied in any way that you can. So let's talk about some of the disk properties. The main thing to be aware of when preserving software on magnetic media is you just cannot preserve the data itself, as you have already seen. There are other properties of the disk that are needed for copy protection checks to pass. We also use the properties to ensure authenticity, but we will come to that shortly. You can describe the information provided by magnetic media as the normal data encoded to whatever is appropriate for the system, for example, the so-called MFM system. You can define the bit densities across the track. You can define the format description of the track. You can define the track geometry, which means basically how the things are laid out on a track, and how the track itself is related to a certain fixed aspect of the disk system. It is quite common to put data near to the index hole of the disk, or just away a countable amount away from the index hole. Or more advanced protections, the data is spaced out in a way that the copy program won't be able to follow. Basically, each track is shifted against each other. The behavior is how the data acts, and that could be more important than the actual data that you are reading from the disk. We already saw that we have flaky bit or weak bit protections, and of course it is meaningless what data you read there. What is meaningful that how the data itself behaves. One of the biggest challenges in preserving original software is finding media that is suitable for preservation, or in fact filtering out that is not suitable. There are many disks submitted to CAPS that are not suitable for preservation, even though they contain commercial software, they may look fine to the casual observer. Why? Well, there are several categories of imperfection, and all render the software as damaged goods for us. There can be physical errors. The disk may be damaged in some way. This can be anything from physical damage to drive failure to actual bitcode that, for example, they have a problem like in the main project for their proms. We think we have probably begun to see the start of real bitrot in disks that are about 18 years old. And obviously this is getting more and more common as the time flies by. To know errors that are existing on a disk, you need to know exactly how the format integrity algorithms work. Some formats do not even contain any integrity information, unfortunately, but luckily this is fairly rare. And these need to be handled in rather more special ways to ensure they are correct. What you see in the picture is at the right, and another algorithm way of getting data from a disk called MFM as well, which is not to be confused with the format itself, and it is magnetic force microscoping. And basically that technology is being used to retrieve data from crashed planes, from black boxes and things like that. Obviously we can't afford that technology and it is not exactly cheap to use that, but we try our best. Another big challenge is modified disks. Errors can sometimes be with that with. You may be applied to special treatment to the disks to get a working copy. This is especially true for certain kind of copy protections where it is known how the copy protection data is generated. For example, the picture we saw about CopyLock Amiga is the data itself is being checked as well, not just the readout of the bit service. And however, the data in itself is created by a special random number generator, which is basically XOR chain. And we can, from a very short segment of damaged data, we can reproduce the original sequence of data on the disk. So, these problems can be dealt with. However, what cannot be dealt with is modified disks. If a disk is modified, there is nothing you can do to salvage it. It's irreparable. Well, at least without using some extremely specialized and expensive equipment, and even then it is not very suitable for small amounts of data. We already saw that picture on the MFM device. And it, due to the way it works, it can move the magnetic heads in a very short intervals, and pretty much on an 80-track disk, it is able to read 800 or even more tracks. So when you write a track to a disk, it leaves its fingerprint on the surrounding environment, and it is possible to read that data out. However, it requires special equipment. Unfortunately, all the games have been manufactured with the write protect tab enabled on the disk. That means they got pretty much modified by the users. Sources for modification include save games, high score saves, virus damage, user themselves hacking the game, and the list just goes on. This is unfortunately all quite common. The risk of modified disks submitted to the project is quite shocking. If you cannot determine the disk that is unaltered and true to its original mastering, then there is no point of doing preservation. Just imagine what would happen if people today realized that a famous work of art has been altered. Exactly the same applies to the games we preserve. The problem of copies. In an attempt to fix broken disk, virus damage or whatever, the game owner quite often decided to copy another, normally hacked version of the game onto the original disk. If the user then sells his collection on, a new owner is not likely to be aware of what has happened to the disk. In this case, or in the case of cracks or pirated software, it is usually easy for everyone to report what has happened. But in the case of a hardware copy, using devices like Cyclone or Synchro Express, this fact is not easy to spot. I already said that there is one way to copy such disks that are so well protected that we are getting into that now. Hardware copies are actually copied via an analog technique. They work by tightly synchronizing the drives and the signals sent from one drive to another. And the way it is done is obviously analog in nature. You can think about it like copying a VHS tape. A copy that you are doing from an original or already copied material is called a generation copy. Each copy generation will be worse in quality than the last one. And exactly the same is true for floppy disks. You already know that if you ever try to copy a VHS tape, that the quality degrades quite often and very fast. It depends on how many generations of the copies are there. The actual data may be the same for the first generation of copy, but the properties of the disk that make up the data degrade until the signals that determine whether a zero or a one is being read are no longer readable. Another factor that you should consider that due to the way particles work, when the disk was mastered, they made sure that the reads are properly spaced out. When you are copying using an analog device, this of course no longer applies. Of course, by copying a VHS tape, you may get a blurry picture and faded colors. But for digital data that was not designed to be redundant, such as data stored on floppy disks, the consequences of losing content means losing non-redundant information. Things such as text, program code, video and audio data that were not designed to be anything less than completely correct. On solid compressed data, such as game levels, missing information renders the raw media unusable, causes memory or other corruptions, since the data was not designed to be missing in the first place. Not only this, but if a game was modified and then copied by this method, there is no way to tell because the copying itself masks the original modification. Let's talk a little bit about the so-called cracks. I'm fairly sure if you had ever had a fairly classic machine, you have encountered them. Cracks are pirated software. The software that appears on the internet that is not tied to its media usually comes in the form of cracks. There are various problems with this type of software, apart from the obvious fact that they represent a piracy scene in itself. These things quite often don't work, and if they do, may still fail later in the game or have graphics or sound corruption. Features of games are sometimes missing, usually stripped out to allow enough space to hurt the cracked version. Quite often the disk is in specially mastered way hold much more data than you can normally hold on such a disk, and to create space for the crack intro. Sometimes, or not so sometimes, developer credits or titles have been replaced, and as such it is unlikely that copyright holders will be exactly happy with these versions being distributed, let alone be preserved as a timeless copy of the game. The high score tables has usually been populated with cracker names and greetings and such stuff, sometimes quite obscene stuff. Cracking a game involves modifying the game code, which means anything can go wrong, and in fact it does. Crackers were in a constant stream of the protection for the fastest distribution as quickly as possible. It does not, of course, say much for ensuring the game actually worked or not. Okay, so now we know what we need for software preservation and the challenges are already set. I will now describe what we have done to solve all these issues raised above, and after, of course, we have found the games themselves. Disk imaging. For various reasons, what you normally read through a floppy disk controller is not what I actually stored on the disk. However, using techniques such as digital signal processing, we do indeed get bit for bit what is on the disk surface using our disk imaging technology. What this tool produces is a file containing raw signal information. This needs further processing in order to obtain a useful image, since we need to define exactly what this image data means by describing the disk format used and the protection applied. What you see in the picture is a commercial duplicator machine. It is called a Trace 7500, and that was a quite common machine. It worked by feeding, describing the format in a language called freeform that is defined by a company called Trace Digital, and they are still around doing CD and DVD protections. And the freeform language describes how the data is stored on the disk, how the data can be read from the master disk, which is normally referred now as code master, referring to the CD process, and how you can write that data back to the disk to produce the same result. You may be wondering why we need to define the disk format. The reason is because we need to know what the data actually means in order to both verify the data is correct and to allow the data to behave as it does on the real media. You also need to define the format if you intend to write the data. This is because you cannot reliably write a disk without knowing how to write it. This is exactly the same in commercial mastering solutions. When writing disks, the duplicator machines were supplied with a master or core disk and a format description file that told the thing how to write the data, how to verify the integrity to ensure that the write was itself successful. We have developed our own format description language as part of our preservation technology. As it happens, we were nearly finished when we were sent a format description file from one of these machines, and it was a freeform source, and it was quite interesting to see that it was very, very similar to what we have already developed on our own. The point is that to do this thing correctly, we followed real commercial mastering principles. Each new format we come across is researched and documented in the format description. This is actually pretty complicated, but to sum it up, you could say that there are various layers of description, and the format is built up using smaller and smaller data elements, right down to the physical encoding used, that is the so-called MFM or GCR or anything format.
So, sorry, my job as a moderator, sorry to interrupt you, is to have a look at the time. Is it possible that you have five more minutes? Because we have to give the audience the opportunity to ask questions afterwards.
I will be very fast, I promise.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay. So what we have as a result is an IP, so-called IPF5, which is short for interchangeable preservation format media file, which can be loaded into an emulator, assuming, of course, that the emulator is accurate enough to work with the original material. Those files contain both data from the raw signal information and, of course, contain the data that enables to regenerate the original disk surface itself. These virtual disks are mastered on the fly. The only difference is that virtual mastering happens in memory, not on disk. And of course, it would be possible to do that as well. We now have both the data and the behavior working exactly how it does on the real system. As with freeform, we have integrity information stored on the disk. We reproduce the algorithm where the data is held and what data it applies to who in order to check it. With hundreds of formats already supported, you can probably go some way to imagine how much work this is. Some formats have no integrity information, but this still can be checked. Checking the correctness of the encoding system used, there are certain rules applying to various encoding systems that can be checked, and if there is a changing in the encoding system, that quite often means that the data is broken. Getting more copies of the game dumped for the comparison. Some games have mastering errors where the integrity information provided by the formatter was not actually checked. Most of these we have been able to find so far good versions for different application RAM. However, there are, of course, some still that we are looking for. If a disk doesn't pass integrity checks, it is very likely that the game will fail at some point through playing. As such, these effects make the game useless for preservation. Authenticity. Since floppy drives are mechanical devices, they each have a unique fingerprint in the way they write the data. This is similar in concept to the way the government agencies match printed paper to the printer that printed it. In the same way, we could match a disk to the system that wrote it. Not only that, but the commercial application hardware used very high quality components, and so the disks written by such equipment look very different to that of a disk written by a home computer system. Since 99% of the games we have seen so far have been commercial mastered, it is easy for us to use to see if the user has somehow submitted a modified disk, since the trends and the analysis will be quite different where the disk is modified. But even in the very rare case that something was actually mastered at home, when we would still be able to see if some tracks were written with a different drive, quite simply because the fingerprint of the drive will be different for the different areas of the disk. Since this is luckily rare, it can be only confirmed by contacting the developers, which we have actually done in the past. With the notable exception of one game that I might tell about if you are interested, it is called Little Computer People, that was modified as part of the duplication process. Any game found to be modified is rejected from a preservation process. The same can be said for copies. Bearing in mind that sheer amount of modified disks out there, there is another absolutely essential step in preservation of software. Disks should be preserved the way they were produced. There is no other way. And, okay, so I'm going to be very fast, I promise more now. Very similar to the layering systems used, for example, in OSI, we define a disk at various layers. The raw image itself, which is the density of the bits itself on the disk, the timing they contain, and the data they represent. There is the second layer is the track geometry, which is defined by various descriptors. The data descriptor defining the data, not what it contains, but how it should look like and how it should behave. The block descriptor is about describing blocks of data elements, and there is a format descriptor that describes blocks of data. The track geometry itself is the format itself, and the physical properties of how it is spaced out on the track itself. This geometry is all the layer 2 data of the disk, that is all the tracks that make up a disk. The IPF file is layer 4, it is the already mentioned format that contains the data to regenerate exactly the same disk geometry for each file preserved. And of course, to back to yesterday's topic, we have metadata that helps categorizing and describing the data that is being preserved, and we do have traces of the files that may be used to link the metadata to the data itself. So we are not relying on some checksum method or anything else. We have assigned IDs to various data. And of course, the big picture itself is having digital libraries sometime in the future, maybe in the very close future, maybe much later, when these artifacts will be available. So basically, we keep searching until we find a copy of the game that is authentic, passes oral integrity tests. For some games, this is very difficult indeed, but we keep trying until we can do. The IPF virtual media file represents the disk content that is both the data on the physical properties that give the data both meaning and the behavior. Since we describe exactly how the disk is made up, any disk-based copy protection check will pass as they get exactly what they expect. This means, of course, no program code, data, or anything is changed in an IPF file. Now, IPF files are sent only to people who submitted the raw signer files in the first place, since we know they own the original material. We also, of course, send them to the developers by request, which happened in the past quite often and still happening as we get more recognized by the developer community. Currently, we are focusing on the Commodore Amiga, partly because it is without doubt the most complicated system in this area. In the near future, we will be transforming into a much more platform-neutral organizations, the Software Preservation Society, which will encompass other disk-based systems such as Atari ST or PC. Since our technology is about dealing with magnetic media, not disks for any particular platform, it is generic, and we will soon reflect to that. One of the problems we face, of course, is resources, but with the help of community, that is getting easier to overcome that problem. One thing for sure, we will not rest until we have done our absolute best to preserve the software that has given all of us many hours of enjoyment. Hopefully, with time, we can work with the games industry much more closely and other institutions to ensure the treasures of our past and our future are not lost forever. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.